afternoon and welcome to the second panel of the day. This panel we're going to be discussing how we build effective cross-border energy relationships. And I've actually just come back from the region. I was traveling in the Gulf, but also around Jordan and a little in Iraq. We've got three very distinguished panelists today. First, we have Sir Michael Lee. Sir Michael is a transatlantic fellow and consultant and a senior advisor to the German Marshall Fund, where he focuses on European neighborhood policy, Eastern Europe, the Mediterranean, and the Middle East, as well as the future of the EU. He began his current role after more than 30 years in EU institutions, hence the knighthood and all the in-depth knowledge. He became Director General for Enlargement with the European Commission after serving for 3 years as External Relations Deputy Director General with responsibility of European Neighbourhood Policy. Then we have Anne Corran. Anne is the co-director of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security. She is an advisor to the US Energy Security Council and chairs the Set America Free Coalition, which is an alliance of national security, environmental, labor, and religious groups promoting ways to reduce America's dependence on oil. And then finally, we've got Henry Tunclap. Henry is a managing partner at CEDA Global Advisors and has a background in political and economic analysis in emerging markets. He covers a variety of sectors in the Eurasia region with a special focus on energy and trade. And prior to that, he was at the German Marshall Fund for the US on energy, geopolitics, and Eurasia. So first of all, I'd like to turn to Sir Michael and his views.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Thanks for the invitation. And I'm really happy to have this opportunity also to get to know ASP and its activities. As we were just saying, there are so many bodies with overlapping interests and activities in Washington. I've been here for nearly a year, and I feel I'm just at the very beginning. So thank you so much for this invitation. I thought I'd begin with just a few words about how I became interested in this subject, because I think that does take us into some of the wider themes. As Paul kindly mentioned, at the European Commission, I was in charge of the EU's negotiations for membership with Cyprus before it joined in 2004. Turkey has been a candidate for membership since 2005. Earlier on, I sort of led the European Commission effort at building up relations with the countries in the Eastern Med, Israel, Syria at the time still, Lebanon, Jordan, the Palestinian administration, Egypt, and others. So I had a very strong interest in this part of the world, including the Cyprus problem, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and other geopolitical questions as they overlapped with the activities of the European Union in the region. In 2011, I left the Commission and started to work as a political consultant in Brussels and with the German Marshall Fund. And scarcely as I'd taken on my new responsibilities, then Noble Energy began drilling offshore Cyprus, and we heard the first challenging or even threatening words from Turkey at the time concerning this. So this really rang a lot of bells with me, as these were countries that I knew very well from previous involvement, and I saw the risk of these resources, which really ought to be for the benefit of all the peoples in the region, instead becoming a source of conflict and exacerbating long-standing disputes. And I started writing about this and then commissioning some papers for the German Marshall Fund. And on that basis then, Noble Energy very kindly and some other partners that supported a project that we've been running at the German Marshall Fund for the last 3 years. We're into the third year now, which is looking exactly at this question of how the resources can best be used to further cooperation in the region rather than to become a new source of conflict. And we have a number of publications by now, approaching 20 publications, looking at different aspects of the problem, including some that I brought along this afternoon, some of the more recent ones, looking at maritime security, a very good paper by two experts from the Center for Naval Analysis, Sarah Vogler and Eric Thompson, who've been looking at the specific risks of naval incidents, inadvertent or intentional, in the Eastern Med as a result of some of the increased presence and patrolling that we heard about in the earlier panel, as well as other possible sparks for conflict, particularly at sea. There's also a new paper by two experts on Lebanon and its prospects and the factors holding back the development of the offshore resources in Lebanon. And a piece by Simon Henderson of the Washington Institute, complementary to the excellent paper from our colleagues at Brookings, looking at Gaza Marine after all, and reminding everybody that these resources, modest though they are present, and if the Palestinian Authority and Israel could come to an agreement for the development, how this could really tackle a number of the energy problems facing the Palestinian administration, but we know what some of the obstacles are there. So this is the background to how I became interested in this subject. And based on our discussion in the first panel and broader considerations, what strikes me compared with the many previous conferences that there have been on this subject, and it has attracted rightfully considerable attention over the last couple of years, is what I would describe as a kind of new realism. If we'd been having this conference a year ago, 2 years ago, all the discussion would have been about global export options from the region, lengthy discussions about LNG versus pipeline, should sales from the Eastern Med be to premium markets in Asia, or should they go to Europe? If Europe, by what means? The Cypriots had very ambitious plans for building an LNG plant in a large site on the southern part of the island. Was this the best way forward? And the European Commission itself became involved in this subject, should there be extremely lengthy pipelines, 1,200 kilometers or so, from the region to connect with the grid that gradually is being built in the European Union itself. So today, we haven't heard about these overambitious plans, and rather we've been looking at domestic use of the gas, first and foremost in Israel and in Cyprus, where it can provide for needs for the next half century or more. Israel is already feeling the benefit of that in a cleaner form of energy. The balance of payments are benefiting from the fact that it's no longer necessary for 60% of the electricity generated in the country to import heavy fuel oil to generate electricity. Those benefits are already being felt, potentially in Cyprus, too small though it is, and several years away though we are from the gas coming on stream on the island. It will be a game changer for the island itself. And then we're looking at much more realistic prospects for sale to the region. Another part of this new realism, I think, are the benefits that have already been achieved in areas like water desalinization, where there is tremendous cooperation between companies from Cyprus and Israel. And water, after all, has been previously, potentially, but also in reality, a major source of conflict in the Middle East, and for Israel at least, and for Cyprus, as a result of the gas, this need no longer be a problem in the future or a source of conflict between Israel and its neighbors. So I do really welcome very much the more level-headed tone of the discussion today compared with some time ago. Nonetheless, there are still some rather unrealistic expectations in various quarters, and I do think it's a good thing to address those as well and to see what the real priorities are. In Europe, for example, as a result of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the question of energy security has come to the top of the agenda It's the main plank in the program of the Juncker Commission, building an energy union in Europe and diversification of supply away from Russia. And there are those who attempted again and again. There was an article in the on the New York Times 10 days ago and to say, well, the Eastern Med could really come in and be a significant source of diversification away from Russia, which I think on the basis of present discoveries is scarcely realistic. The outgoing Greek government, at least, I haven't heard so much from the new government, talked extensively about these projects of common interest, which were in fact projects on paper only, that would have brought either electricity generated from Eastern Med gas or the gas itself to Europe via Crete and the Peloponnesus. This is included in the list of projects that could potentially be financed partly from European funds, but where the technical and financial and commercial obstacles are very great. Another continuing source of interest, but rather unrealistic one, I think, at least for the time being, is the question of potential sales from Israel to Turkey. We know that the companies concerned engaged in quite detailed discussions some time ago. But clearly, not only in the present prevailing political climate, and given the leaders of Turkey and of Israel and their proven animosity, there is a lack of a political basis for this, but also, actually, an earlier paper in this series by Tassos Yamourides really called into question the received wisdom that were it not for the political constraints, exports to Turkey would be commercially the most logical and viable. And in fact, he looked at in considerable detail at different sources of supply to Turkey, demand patterns within Turkey, price considerations, and came to the conclusion that, after all, even in commercial terms, this was unlikely to be viable, at least under present circumstances. But there are those who, understandably, particularly in diplomatic circles, would like to see Eastern Med gas as a kind of catalyst for rapprochement between Israel and Turkey, and indeed as an element that could help the talks that are just getting underway again on Cyprus to try and find a solution to the problem of the division of the island. And I think here, too, one has to say that these expectations are rather unrealistic. As we heard in the first panel, I think part of the new realism is to understand that there really are no peace pipelines as such. There are virtually no cases in the world in which an open political conflict has been overcome as a result of energy cooperation. What we do see is that where a minimum of trust has been established between parties, as for example in what may be a cold peace between Israel and Egypt or between Israel and Jordan, then energy cooperation can come in and can reinforce the trust that has with difficulty been established or is in the process of being established. But it's not something which can come in, as we heard the term also in the first panel, a kind of deus ex machina to solve political problems that otherwise would not be resolved. So when we refer back to the new realism of essentially domestic consumption, all the benefits that brings, and exports to the region in the first instance, pending new discoveries, which we hope will materialize in the years ahead. Nonetheless, there are still very important challenges. The infrastructure for bringing the gas onshore and for sending it particularly to Egypt, Jordan is less challenging because of the very small distances involved and the link with the existing Israeli network that can easily be built. Clearly, there are questions about finance. In fact, who are going to be the investors that will come in and build this network, modest network of pipelines that will be needed to connect the offshore fields to Jordan, to Egypt, by which route, and on what price assumptions? These are questions that still need to be tackled. We have a new paper that's coming out shortly, which is looking at some of these complex technical and financial issues. The Cypriot Minister for Energy, Yorgos Lakotrypis, has approached the European Commission and asked it to conduct a major feasibility study on the pipeline network for the Eastern Med on the assumption that EU funds could come in as a complement to funds from the private sector to help build some of this infrastructure. And in this paper, we've been looking at the extent to which the European Investment Bank, the new facility which has been put forward by Mr. Juncker as a major part of this Commission's program, and which is dedicated partly to infrastructure, including energy, could be used to help co-finance at least part of this new pipeline network. So I think there are a lot of much more concrete and down-to-earth questions that we can look at as to how to make a reality of this cross-border cooperation that we've been talking about. Certainly now I think the foundations for it have been laid. The political will is there. The main narrative, I think, is that notwithstanding political risk and political uncertainty, notwithstanding the fact that in Jordan, for example, there have been some demonstrations, there have been some members of parliament who have spoken out against energy cooperation with Israel, nonetheless, it's clear that the king, the government, the Minister of Energy, the government as a whole, is determined to go ahead with this project. And similarly, the Egyptian government seems to be solidly behind it as well. So I think we have a number of grounds for optimism about the scenario, but there are many challenges still there, which I'm sure we're going to address in the rest of this panel and in this afternoon's proceeding. So thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be here. I'll start with the kind of the broader, the large regional context, and then go into the narrow regional context, the country context, the environmental factors that are also at play, and of course, the kind of interplay between the regulators and the companies, the consortium. So the broader regional context, we have this rising, simmering, burbling Sunni-Shia conflict. Within that context, we have a situation in which the Gulf Arabs, I think, strongly believe that we're on the verge of a Sunni-Shia nuclear arms race. That context cannot be ignored. We have a race for leadership in the Sunni world, which is very important because we have Turkey, Egypt, and also in their own way, Qatar and Saudi Arabia vying for leadership, pulling the Sunni world in different directions. And we, of course, have this rise of the Islamic State and radical Sunni Islam in general. And that brings us to the narrower regional context in which it's very, very important to maintain stability and maintain this rational Sunni leadership in Egypt, secular Sunni leadership in Egypt and in Jordan. Right? It's hard to think of a more rational leadership in the region than the Hashemites of Jordan going back for a long time. And to compare al-Sisi to anybody else in the region, one simply has to look at his performance during Coptic Christmas Mass and the rock star reception he received from the Copts when he came to greet them and to celebrate the holiday with them. I think that was a very significant moment, and that's kind of indicative of al-Sisi type of Egypt. So it's very, very important to help maintain stability in those two countries. And at the same time, we have this influx of Syrian refugees into Jordan that's very destabilizing for Jordan. We have this growth of energy demand in both countries. We have a situation in which the clock is ticking, and nobody's going to wait for the Israeli government to get its act together. Right now, the Israeli government is in formation. It's highly unexpected that anything is going to happen on this issue, anything is going to move before the summer. They're probably waiting until the last minute to form a government, and once the government forms, you have all of these different regulatory bodies and that need to get their act together and start moving in the same direction, and a government that needs to establish a policy to get everybody moving in the same direction, and a policy that's acceptable to the consortium. But at the same time, you know, Jordan isn't waiting. Jordan has Qatar as a ready and willing supplier of energy.
Egypt isn't waiting. It signed an MOU with Cyprus for Aphrodite, gas from Aphrodite. So nobody is waiting. The price of oil has fallen, and that's significant for the consortium because the price of natural gas is linked to oil. So outlook for exports elsewhere all of a sudden is much, much bleaker. Your return is much, much lower. And add to all of that that you have a as was alluded to in the earlier panel, a populist sentiment in Israel, where in this country, in the United States, I think we had a very problematic situation over the last decade in certain sectors of the economy where we were socializing risks for which rewards were privatized. Well, here you're facing the opposite problem in which you're trying to, in a way, socialize rewards for which the risks were entirely privatized. And it's very hard to go to companies and say, you know what, you went into an area where nobody expected to find anything at your own risk, at tremendous investment, where there were no, as was mentioned in the earlier panel, personnel you had to train from scratch in the area, bring in from outside, and now you have this golden egg, and we're going to decide how to divvy it up all over again and change the rules in midstream. That doesn't inspire a great deal of confidence. So that's on the negative side. On the positive side, again, if you look at the potential here, where you find gas and oil, you're going to find more gas and oil. So it's likely that we're just scratching the surface in terms of the potential finds. The problem is that nobody, until there's confidence established, not only within the existing companies, but among the broader investment community looking at potential Israeli energy investments, until there's confidence established that we know what the rules are, and we know that they're not going to change, and we can safely invest and know what our return, at least assuming that we actually overcome technical hurdles and other risks, we know that the government is not going to change the rules of the games on us. That's really, really important. So none of that potential is going to be realized. The other factor in terms of potential is if you look at Egypt and Jordan and Israel, it's not just electricity prices that you can support and help bring down with a local supply of natural gas. It's potentially also transportation fuel. Oil price is very moderate now, you know, the mid two digits, but it will certainly go up. With the earlier comments I made about the broader regional context, which is of course kind of the source of the price for the black liquid around the world, despite restricting its supply for years. And so, for Egypt and for Jordan and for Israel, transportation fuel cost is a major, major factor, and the ability to send natural gas into the transportation sector, convert it to liquid fuels, use it in the transportation sector is another important thing to consider. None of this will come to fruition until there's a meeting of the minds between the regulators and the companies. And one thing that's often missed is that they're not exactly ultra deep sea operators waiting in line to move in and take Nobel's place. And the fact is that you need a super experienced ultra deep sea operator to come in there because of the environmental sensitivity. You cannot have an operator that doesn't have sufficient experience and risk a situation like we had here in the Gulf of Mexico. And granted, we're talking about gas and not oil, but below gas and with gas, there is liquid. And it could, if there's an operator that comes in because of a forced sale that doesn't have sufficient experience, there could be a complete environmental disaster. We heard in the last panel about the importance of tourism income for Egypt. Tourism income is also important for Israel. And tourism income is very dependent on nice, pristine, and beautiful beaches. So having that affected in any way, I think, is a factor that also needs to be taken into consideration. And there also needs to be an understanding that at the end of the day, there is a point at which Atlas will shrug. If the companies do not see a sufficient return, if you push them hard enough, either through price controls, either through a forced sale below the return that they want and they need given their investment, and remember that there's zero risk here. This is a prime asset. It is an asset, if you look at Leviathan, that a seller would want a very high premium for, because you know what you have available. The numbers are only going to increase It's a very solid asset. So forcing an undermarket sale, which may be what it takes to actually get a sale, is going to be tremendously negative for the future of energy development, and I think foreign investment writ large in the region. And I have a lot more to say, but I think I'll leave it at that. And
yes. Emery.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks to ASB for inviting me to this panel and to be able to speak with this distinguished set of panelists. So maybe I thought I would talk a little bit about Turkey, because I think the first panel laid out the groundwork nicely and raised some of the questions, although it's obviously not one of the countries that has in the region that has these natural resources, but I feel like it's always part of the conversation most of the time within those geopolitical realm of obstacles and challenges. But also, I think Tim mentioned, and Andrew as well in the first panel, to Turkey's own consumption and its own increasing need for more natural gas. So I think it might be useful to actually talk a little bit about Turkish perspective in terms of their needs and how they see energy policy and the regional energy strategy overall. So I think obviously, you know, the emphasis was made on during the first panel on Turkey's decades-long ambition to become first a transit hub, first a transit country, and then an energy hub to actually, you know, meet taking advantage of the geopolitical position. And Turks would love to emphasize that a lot, the strategic location between the supply centers and the demand centers. But in addition to that, I think there is a real sense of consumption increase in the country, and especially in terms of oil and gas. And the basic fact that, you know, Turkey basically gets 98% of its natural gas is imported and 92% of its oil. So the need is there, and Turkey is virtually one of the countries that still has, in Europe, virtually the only country that has any significant additional projected demand, especially when it comes to oil and gas within the next decade, to make any investor or company excited about the prospect. So I think this is really driving Turkey's desire to be more proactive when it comes to its foreign policy approach, and, you know, sometimes even trying to take advantage of some of the conflicts in this region, and that does not necessarily mean that everything that's happening, you know, from Ankara's standpoint is good, because when they look around, they see a lot of, problems and a lot of crises in their backyard. But I think to a certain extent, when it comes to energy, when Turkish policymakers looked around, they've seen a window of opportunity. Because, you know, when you look at the, even from a global context, when you look at the price of oil, you know, from where it was in 2008, around $150 per barrel, now around 55 to 60 band. And for a country like Turkey that runs a huge current account deficit, and that's largely caused by oil and gas imports, I think the numbers are something like every $10 drop in oil price, Turkey saves $4 billion. So it's really huge. And when you go down and look at the regional context, you look at some of the new potential suppliers emerging, and you have the Ukraine crisis, which really highlighted the role of Southern Gas Corridor, Eastern Mediterranean, Iraq, and all of those projects that could potentially involve Turkey, as a transit country. In addition, there's also the need, as I mentioned. So I think this is really, in a sense, a good time for Turkey. Not a good time, but I think there's definitely a window of opportunity. So I think the Eastern Med is a little different than in terms of Turkey's approach to the whole regional energy strategy than the attitude that I think Turkey has taken when it comes to Russia or Iraq. So I think for the first time, obviously, you know, we can talk, we can go on and on and on about Turkey's new foreign policy approach, and there's been many panels organized in Washington about it, and obviously there are significant flaws, and many would argue that it's failed to a large extent when it comes to at least Middle East, but then again, the region is so complicated that you can't blame one for, you know, being wrong on some of those developments. But at the same time, I think when you look at Turkey's relationship with Russia, and how the government has been able to, in a way, compartmentalize different issues. You know, like a lot of people were really worried when they had, you know, Turkey was one of the main proponents of removal of President Assad in Syria, and obviously, you know, they have a clear divergence of opinion with Russia about that and some of the other foreign policy issues. But despite that, Turkey has managed to build upon its ongoing energy relationship with Russia. You know, Russians are now building a Turkish nuclear reactor, and now there's a potentially a new pipeline that's being built to replace South Stream. And same pragmatic approach, I think, when it comes to northern Iraq. Again, not a completely safe approach. At times, it frustrated Washington when Turkey decided to go ahead with its, partnership with the Kurdistan regional government and becoming the biggest trade and trade partner with the KRG region there. But you could see that, you know, despite Turkey's own Kurdish issue and some of the other broader regional problems that they had. But I think to a large extent, especially when it comes to Israel and Cyprus, Turkey's attitude, I think, has been mostly, especially Israel, has been really determined by domestic concerns, especially since 2010, obviously the Mavi Marmara incident. And I feel like ever since then, there's been an understanding in the Turkish government that this kind of almost anti-Israel rhetoric really resonates well domestically in terms of the voters. And I think all these additional, the rise of the additional suppliers and all these potential suppliers opening up, all these new routes for imports, I think really caused Turkey, at least Cyprus and Israel or Eastern Mediterranean, to go down a little bit, as far as I can say, in terms of the list of priorities, because now you have the opportunity of maybe getting more gas from Russia, through the Turkish stream, which I think is also worth mentioning, because what's happening between Russia, Greece, and Turkey as it relates to Turkish stream is actually very interesting, because although Prime Minister Tsipras was really careful to stop Putin last week, I think during the press conference when he referred to it as Turkish stream, he was like, okay, now as soon as it hits the Greek territory, we won't be calling it Turkish stream anymore. But they're still, I think, really at least open to the idea of this kind of cooperation, which is, I think, which is pretty significant, while we have all these like seemingly frozen conflicts in the Eastern Mediterranean that involve Turkey. And I think this is pretty pessimistic again, I think, unfortunately. But maybe like one final note in terms of Turkey's relationship with Israel. Despite all of this, despite the fact that energy minister said numerous occasions that there won't be any Turkish involvement in bringing Israeli gas unless they change their Gaza policy and things significantly change in that part of the world. President Erdogan himself, after being elected as president in August, mentioned, as long as I'm in power, we won't have a change in Israel policy unless they change their stance on major issues. And so that's pretty much saying we're not going to do anything. But at the same time, it's really interesting, because I think this bilateral relationship is really unique in the sense that they know how to be pragmatic when they have to. And you can actually look at the trade numbers between Israel and Turkey to actually realize that it's been on an upward trend almost ever since 2011. So when you look at the trade numbers in 2014, it went up 11% compared to 2013. And arguably, 2013-14 was again a year where relationship took another dip after the official apology 2 years ago. And then you had the summer of 2014, the Gaza war again. And then but you see that both exports from Israel to Turkey and from Turkey to Israel really went up. So I think that's good in the sense that as long as there is some private sector interest in this route, and Sir Michael Lee made a point to that, there was strong Turkish private sector interest in this project until again last summer. I think this shows that pragmatic attitude can actually prevail in this relationship, but it's just a matter of whether both sides see it as worthwhile pursuing. And I think on the Turkish side, at least for now, there isn't any sense of urgency. Same thing with the Cyprus issue, unfortunately, because with these like changing geopolitical backdrop in the region, I think really makes Turkey see Cyprus issue as less of a priority than it used to. But at the same time, at least it's a personal assessment, from a public perception standpoint, if and when a solution or a resolution to this problem can be achieved, I think it's less of an issue in the minds of Turkish people in terms of, oh yeah, we've really given in and we really sacrificed that much. I think the fact that it's less of a priority also means that if there are some concessions to be made, I think both sides would have to if there is a resolution, then there will be less of a backlash, which really, I think, takes away some of that political risk element to it if a government wants to go through with it. And I think I'll stop there for now so we can...
No, thank you so much. I'll take questions from the audience in a second. I just want to go through some of the sort of key issues that all three of you have raised. I mean, so Michael, you said that this energy stability, this energy growth could be a reinforcing factor to any political trust that's created. How can organizations like the EU, how can the US help create that political trust that the energy found can reinforce and build upon?
We can do it at different levels. And the US can do it in situations where the EU can't. For example, on Cyprus, it's extremely difficult for the EU to take initiatives because it's not perceived as objective by Turkey, because Greece is a member of the European Union, Cyprus is a member of the European Union. And therefore, in nudging the political process further forward on Cyprus, and in seeing whether there is any link between the comprehensive settlement talks and energy issues, the US is much better placed to do that than the EU is. I think between Israel and its neighbors, probably the same broadly applies, even though the EU is the main provider of assistance to the Palestinians, for example. And therefore, I think there's some leverage that comes with that. But apart from the kind of official encouragement that, for example, Vice President Biden has taken in the case of Cyprus, the first vice president to visit the island since LBJ, there are initiatives at the Track 2 level and the Track 1.5 level that the US and the EU can encourage, can perhaps fund to some extent. With the General Marshall Fund, we've organized such events in the past. We've tried to find areas for, I mean, confidence-building measures, it's almost like a dirty word in the region. It's very hard to use that terminology, but to find areas of possible cooperation which are non-political. And you very rightly mentioned the whole environmental field and the risks of an offshore accident and... In the first session, we heard the risk also of a more security nature concerning the energy installations. And there it seems to me that there is a very strong interest of all parties. I mean, if ever there were to be an oil spill, the whole of the region, depending on the currents and the prevailing winds, could be affected. So we made a serious effort to bring the parties together and to encourage them. Of course, after that, it's up to them. And then the political constraints come in. And it's notoriously difficult for efforts at Track 2 or Track 1.5 level to percolate up to the political level. But I think there are a range of areas where, quietly behind the scenes, both the EU and the US have a role to play.
And you touched on sort of the wider implications of foreign investment in Israel and sort of wider support for Israel. That is, that the process is really putting at risk. Can you sort of expand on what those problems are?
Well, Israel has been a fantastic place for foreign investment, particularly in its high tech sector. It's never had to deal with natural resources before. And so, you know, you have this very young country dealing with, for it, a tremendous resource boon and kind of trying to wade its way through it. While it's like learning to run a sprint while you're in the middle of the sprint and you've never practiced before. It's very, very hard. And I think the government's government's attention was also not sufficiently and coherently focused on this one issue so as to get one coherent regulatory voice and regulatory policy from the get-go so that they wouldn't reach these various crisis points with the consortium. So when you're looking at the broader potential, not just the existing fields, and developing these existing fields and extracting energy from them, but also finding other fields in Israel's territorial waters and other countries' territorial waters in the region. If investors are not confident that they know what the rules of the game are and that they can lay out a certain risk for which they don't know that they're going to get a reward, but if they do have a find, they will not face a changing regulatory regime, it's going to be very hard to get them interested. And don't forget that in the Israeli context in specific, unlike other countries, there's the Arab boycott to deal with. So an operator that's an ultra-deep sea operator has to have two qualifications. Other than being tremendously experienced because of the environmental factors, they also have to not have conflicting business interests that would be damaged by the Arab boycott. That list is really very, very short. And so the likelihood that you're going to find, there's not companies waiting in line to replace Nobel here.
And I would imagine then that it's not just in the natural resources sector that this would impact on, but actually any large-term infrastructure development projects that if, you know, regulation is changed in one sector, companies are worried about it changing in their sector.
Of course. And you also have a situation, if you look at the energy sector there, there's been all this talk about the gas monopoly, so to speak. The gas going into electricity sector, on the way there's an electricity company monopoly that is dealing with a very large and powerful union for which the political will to manage that union, reduce its power, reduce the bloat in that company, and therefore the cost to ratepayers, it's hard to see if that political will is going to be there. You know, so there are a lot of different factors that make it seem like the focus of the entire monopolistic blame on the natural gas and the companies dealing with the gas is just not quite very fair.
Yeah. And then, Amri, you talked about, you know, the growing demand of energy in Turkey. I mean, we're going to see this in Egypt especially, and in Jordan, these countries with growing demand, and yet they are faced all around with great areas of instability. And we see, you know, we talked about the Sunni-Shia issue and the fragmentation of Iraq, the falling apart of Syria. How does Ankara, which seems to be this ocean of stability right now, view that in sort of energy terms, do you think?
Right, I think part of the strategy has been to play along with some of those as much as you can. I think we saw this to a large extent in Iraq. You know, Turkey made the decision, Ankara, to actually go ahead with this, you know, trade partnership and energy partnership with the KRG, and they started building those pipelines. And before that, they started receiving the oil via, you know, different trucks and storing it at the Ceyhan terminal. And despite, I mean, as I mentioned, despite all these warnings from Washington that, you know, you should definitely involve Baghdad in this relationship, so they tried to go around it by, you know, trying to create these different sorts of payment schemes that would then get approval of Baghdad. So, so I think in a sense they haven't really hesitated to push forward with some of them. And on the other hand, you have some of the other. So right now, Turkey still gets a lot, around 10 BCM of its natural gas from Iran. So about 30 BCM. So this year's projections from the ministry is about 45 to 50 BCM of consumption natural gas, and 10 BCM would be from Iran, and around 30 BCM is expected to come from Russia. There's 5 to 6 from LNG, mostly from Algeria, and then the rest is Azerbaijan. So obviously, the Southern Gas Corridor is something that Turkey pursues very extensively, and there's the political will, and there was the groundbreaking ceremony of the Tanap pipeline, the Trans-Anatolian pipeline that will then be joined by the Trans-Adriatic pipeline, and these are really also in a way EU priority projects as well. And again, going back to the whole changing dynamics and the highlighted nature of these different energy diversification routes for Europe, I think Turkey is really willing to push forward with those. That being said, I think the whole foreign policy approach, being more proactive and more involved with some of the crisis, to the point where in a few instances we saw Turkey picking sides, which can be really dangerous in a place like the Middle East. And I think although it kind of creates this different ways of cooperation when it comes to energy supply, it also can lead to really difficult situations that will be hard to come back from. So I think it's maybe the fact that some of those new energy suppliers are also new to the game help Turkey's case when dealing with some of those players, because they also don't have a lot of experience in terms of leveraging their energy resources for foreign policy and regional politics. But at the same time, I think, my own impression is that people in Ankara have started to realize that there should probably, the right approach should be somewhere in the middle, sort of not as passive as some would call the previous government's foreign policy approach, but maybe not as proactive as they were the past couple of years.
Very interesting. So if you'd like to ask a question, just raise your hand. We've got a microphone, and tell me who you are and who you come from. Hugo?
Thanks. Hi. Lisa Friedman. I write for Climate Wire. We're an energy policy magazine. And I usually focus on the UN climate negotiations, where all of the countries that we've talked about have lay very low and don't have much to say. But I actually have a question specific to Turkey. I understand that the government signaled a couple of years ago a move away from gas and towards domestic coal. Can you talk a little bit about that? And, you know, I mean, to what extent Turkey's future energy needs can be met by coal or by renewables, which I understand are pretty small still. Thanks.
Sure. So coal has been a very politically loaded topic in Turkey, especially because you have all these old coal mines and you have all these problems with, not problems, but all these issues related to unions, and they're really politically very active. And it has been a challenge for successive Turkish governments to actually phase out coal, although it's been one of the policy items on the agenda for a long time. And I think the recent, and renewable energy, on the other hand, has also been pretty disappointing, especially from a investor standpoint, because it's been almost a decade now that the foreign investors have been waiting for the Turkish government to come up with some significant roadmap in terms of how they want to go ahead with some of their targets. And I think the 2010, 2011 was the period where there was a lot of anticipation. And unfortunately, the legislation that the Turkish government came up with was not even close to what the investors were expecting. But that, having said that, especially when it comes to things like solar power, I think a lot of things have changed over the past 5 years in terms of cost structures and so on and so forth. And actually, very recently, Turkey came up with the new renewable energy strategy. I think in November last year they released, and the plan is to get something around, I think, 15% of the, or maybe 20%, if I'm not mistaken, of the total electricity from renewable by 2030. Again, it's one of those targets that sound really exciting and fancy, and it sounds great on the paper, but at the same time, I think people really realize that there are all these different challenges when it comes to things like how much local input you have to have in terms of your investment, and I think Turkey is still a little conservative when it comes to some of those regulation pieces, but at the same time, this new package was supported by the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development, and it's being seen as this new drive to really push forward this time with the renewable. And one thing to understand is Turkey, in all of these projects, hydropower counts as renewable. And Turkey, it's still the first on the list in terms of non-fossil. So that dilutes the whole effect a little bit, but yeah.
I'm just going to ask some follow-on questions. And so, Michael, on Cyprus in particular, what are the issues that Cyprus you think are going to face now that they have the found these gas fields and to take forward within the European Union and export in the region?
I think there are different levels of the challenge. I mean, in the first instance, it would be necessary to build the infrastructure to bring the gas onshore. Some 150 plus kilometers, it's really a significant distance and expense, and there are many technical issues. So that has to be agreed. Final investment decisions are needed. Investors need to take commitments. And then the whole question of exports also needs to be further pursued beyond the initial understandings that have been reached so far. So, I mean, they have many, many issues really related to the development of the offshore fields as such, plus, of course, continuing exploration and keeping the companies who are already involved interested and willing to continue to explore. And it may well be, it was said earlier, that we're only at the beginning of significant further discoveries. A friend of mine says that energy companies usually have the right instincts and go for the juiciest holes first. So, I mean, who knows what this will prove to be. In any event, even on the basis of existing discoveries, I think for Cyprus, it is a game changer and it has to now be brought to market. But this is just one of three major challenges they face. The other is emergence from the financial and economic crisis. And I think it's a very good thing that the gas will only come on stream, you know, if we're hopeful towards the end of the decade. And by then, the economy will have to be up and running based on other initiatives and diversification rather than excess dependence on the energy field to help the economy revive, which is a very good thing. And finally, efforts to pursue the talks on reaching a comprehensive settlement. That will start up again, really, following this month's elections in the north. So there are these three sets of overlapping challenges that the country faces, and which are really very, very demanding indeed, and where there are very clear overlaps between these different sets of issues.
And it must, the issues with Greece must obviously affect that.
Indirectly. Yeah. I mean, in the... I mean, there's a lot of consideration now as to what will happen with Greece and the euro. The general trend in thinking on this issue is that if the worst came to the worst and Greece needed to leave the euro, this is something that could perhaps be isolated and that there wouldn't necessarily be spillover effects, particularly as the Greek government is pursuing policies that are quite different from those being pursued by other vulnerable economies like Cyprus or Portugal or Italy, for that matter, as the Greek government has been calling into question the Troika program, whereas Cyprus has been doing its best to implement it, even though there's a very difficult issue in the parliament with the necessary laws for foreclosures. So if Greece were to drop out of the euro, would that have a knock-on effect on Cyprus? Perhaps, but not inevitably.
And Anne, you mentioned President Sisi and what was going on in Egypt. How can the US and allies, European Union, push forward supporting the Egyptian government, especially as we're reaching the hot months and the desperate need that Egypt actually has for energy, for transport, as well as electricity, and all those issues?
I think we also have to put that in the context of a very real sense of betrayal that secular Sunnis and Sunnis in general have right now vis-a-vis the United States. First, there's a sense of betrayal of the American security guarantee by the Persian Gulf Sunnis, and that's certainly felt by Egypt as well. And second, there's the whole situation with the toppling of Mubarak and the support, perceived support for the Muslim Brotherhood, and the lack of support for al-Sisi. So putting that in context, it's really important to try and get the relations on as solid ground as possible, because he's a very positive actor in the region. You know, you can't be that picky. You just simply cannot be that picky.
I was talking to somebody yesterday about the Iran deal, and it went down to the fact that we have a deal now, or we have the unicorn. And it's a sort of a similar issue of CC or the unicorn.
CC or the unicorn, I wouldn't agree on the Iran deal, but absolutely not. I think we have a deal, or we have a better deal. But in the Egyptian context, definitely,
yeah.
it's CC or it's a disaster.
Yeah.
So and we definitely want to be helpful to Egypt in any way possible. And you know, you have a country that has a lot of poor people,
yeah.
and a very large and growing young population, and a serious need for energy.
We've sort of abandoned and not looked at Egypt for a long while and not realized that the economy is not very well at all. There's almost 100 million Egyptians with a desperate need for power.
Yeah, and
electricity.
And you know, one of the things going back a little bit, but the unrest that led to the toppling of Mubarak actually followed some attempts to reform the Egyptian economy and roll back some subsidies that, while they were momentarily helpful to a poor population, were in a way really holding back the development of the economy and holding back allowing people to lift themselves out of poverty eventually.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of structural reforms that need to happen there. But I will say this. The issue right now is a issue within Israel. Okay. The secondary issue is moving the energy from these fields elsewhere. But until you resolve the issue within Israel, the political issue, the regulatory issue, get an agreement between the regulator and the companies, there's no conversation to really be had about moving excess energy over to Egypt or Jordan or anywhere else. That's the problem. The problem right now is in Israel.
Well worth reminding.
Thank you. So one question I want to ask, I guess for the whole panel. You know, the Middle East, obviously you've got major energy producers in the Gulf, major energy producers in the north, in Russia. To what extent do these kind of outside actors, and I'm thinking especially about Russia, do they play a spoiler role here? Do they play a beneficial role in, you know, either the internal Israeli politics? I know in Egypt, there's been a deal signed with Gazprom to supply LNG to Egypt. Russia is not shy about using its energy power for geopolitical ends. Is that happening here? Is there a potential for that happening?
I mean, so Michael, I mean, from an EU perspective, you know, Russia's, he's right up against it with Russia in Ukraine and the energy politics they're playing that, the energy spoilers.
I think, yes, and diversification of dependence on Russian gas and oil is a major priority for the Commission. And therefore, if Russia were to succeed, as it has not until now, in finding a way to be part of the puzzle of the Eastern Med, I think this would be scrutinized very closely. I mean, if some of the companies were in the end obliged to divest themselves of some of their holdings, and if Russian companies were to bid to come in, I mean, this would be a certain cause of geopolitical concern. And they've expressed a strong interest in Cyprus as well until now, even though there was a brief moment when it looked as though Novatek might become involved. That didn't happen. But it's clear that Russia doesn't, or Gazprom in particular, but other Russian companies and the Russian government is not very content to see these developments go ahead without their becoming involved. So this is something that Brussels would look at with a wary eye.
And just in one comment on Russia, again, in the broader context, And because of the European situation, I think Russia's primary focus when it comes to energy, and it certainly does use energy as a political tool, is developing other markets. That's why it's going to China. That's why the Turkish market is a tremendous, Turkey is a bottomless pit in terms of potential for energy demand. I mean, Turkish Stream, I don't think they even need to extend it beyond Turkey. They could get such a lot of demand out of Turkey that if it goes further, it's going to be almost irrelevant to them. So I think kind of the European unhappiness with Russia, at the same time that Russia feels it has been a very, very reliable supplier to Europe through Nord Stream, and that the problem is actually Ukraine and not Russia, that's how the Russians feel, has led Russia to just say, we don't like this monopsony situation, and we're going to find other customers.
And sort of the Turkish aspect, I mean, how does Ankara feel about this, especially in relation to the destabilization Russia's caused in Syria and other countries around?
Right. I mean, Ankara received a lot of criticism especially from NATO allies in terms of its approach to Russia and some of the issues surrounding it. There's been a couple of articles, discussions questioning Turkey's role within the NATO, whether it's very recently on New York Times as well, whether Turkey can still be trusted as an ally. And I think all of this, to a certain extent, has to do with the fact that although it criticized Russia's actions in Ukraine with a very strong language, Turkish Foreign Ministry and Turkey overall, it did not go along with the sanctions regime, and it actually decided to develop a closer ties with Russia when it comes to energy. So this has not been easy in terms of when it comes to explaining it to transatlantic partners, I think. But at the same time, I think there's the understanding that from the Russian side, especially when it comes to the EU, some of the regulatory challenges, and now with the energy union and the move towards diversification, it's becoming more and more difficult for Russia to get more involved in things like downstream or purchasing actual assets in the EU or other country territories. So I think that's also part of Russia's strategy now to become more of a supplier. So just selling the gas and providing the gas and diversification of, really rallying its current customers and the countries that are buying and trying to get new ones. So I think in that sense, it's maybe changed a little bit Russia's strategy as well as it relates to its immediate neighborhood. But I think in terms of the Turkey-Russia relationship, it's pretty much, historically, it's a difficult relationship because there's a strong sense of rivalry. And that's why a lot of people were really expecting what reaction Turkey would give right after the Crimea incident occurred, because obviously the Tatars there and the ethnically Turkic people and all those historical ties. But I think given everything, considering everything that's happened, I think it's they've played okay game, I think. But also more importantly, I think for the first time in that relationship, Turkey-Russia, when it comes to energy, Turkey feels like it has the upper hand when it comes to the negotiations. So I think that's a very different thing, and it's really they're trying to adjust to this new reality. But at the same time, when it comes to Eastern Med and some of the other issues, I think Russian sea power or Russian ambitions there are still are being considered with a grain of salt by Turks. It's not embracing each other. Yeah,
interject a word. I mean, time will tell whether Turkish Stream is ever built or not. And I mean, it was a little bit a rabbit out of the hat at the time when South Stream was cancelled, right, following the various objections that were raised by the European Commission. And I think this was Putin wishing to show that Russia still had options. Right. But, you know, the financial, the technical issues, the demand, the cost, I mean, and the investment funds required, I would say the court is out as to whether this will become a reality or not, just as it was with South Stream.
Hello. I'm an intern with the Environmental and Energy Study Institute doing their climate energy program.
I was wondering how an international climate agreement could affect the cooperative development of the natural gas resources that you've been talking about, and also the region's energy mix as a whole.
And that's a great question. It's on natural gas issues, and we touched on it with coal. Climate change is going to affect the area. What are your thoughts on it? Would a UN agreement have any effect?
There's not going to be a realistic international climate agreement. No way, no how.
Are you sure?
You have to remember that a third of the people on this planet live in China or India, okay? And they're not going to give up coal. Because if they give up coal, that means they're going to stay poor. And they're not willing to stay poor just to soothe the consciousness of Western elites.
Oh, seemingly. That are
very well fed and very well air conditioned in the summer and very well heated in the winter. Let me put it that way.
Plus, of course, use of coal is on the increase in some of the countries that are most committed to these climate goals, like Germany, with natural gas plants being put in mothballs simply because of the cost considerations, and exports of coal are really rising very dramatically from the United States and being used in Germany of all places. But I mean, in the region, I think some of the main challenges concern the degree to which natural gas can itself help to achieve some of the goals of reducing emissions as a sort of intermediary solution. And compared with burning coal or heavy fuel oil, there's absolutely no doubt that it's a huge improvement. And one can even see that in atmospheric terms in Israel today. But given their natural advantages of both Israel and Cyprus and potentially Lebanon and so on, for renewables, for simply economic reasons, rather than for meeting targets of an international agreement that might or might not be reached, they haven't really found the formula for a balanced energy strategy. You know, there are those in Cyprus who argue a little implausibly, I think, that some of the revenues from the gas could be used to stimulate renewables. I don't see a market mechanism whereby that could work, although maybe the government could play some kind of role. So I think the countries really need a good overall energy strategy and need to reach their own views as to the appropriate energy balance without going over 100% to natural gas, which could be a very strong temptation for them.
I think this has been a really interesting panel that we started off talking about the sort of major challenges, but actually I think we've discussed there are ways forward in doing this, even though they may be very difficult. So I'd just like to thank you all. This has been really interesting. And our next panel will start in about 10 minutes, just after coffee. Thank you so much.
Thank you.